Here we are again, Sue Hall and Tristan McDonald here, August 9th, with another podcast in the whole Dyslexic Society's first series, Talk the Dys Out of Dyslexia. Today, Sarah Kramer joins us from the UK. She studied the connection between perceptual talent and dyslexia for her master's, and you'll really enjoy her shipwreck exercise, which sheds light on how we think and why this is such an important question that goes unasked. We have a wonderful visitor today. Sarah Kramer is joining us from the UK. And I had the pleasure of virtually meeting Sarah when we had a webinar with the UK facilitators. And I discovered that she has been researching into all sorts of wonderful things. And Tristan is here as well, obviously, because it was his idea for the podcasts. So I'm going to introduce you purely as a Davis facilitator since 2002. And maybe you'd like to add the rest, Sarah.
Yeah, hi. Well, it's lovely to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me. As you said, I was a Davis facilitator for, 18 years. And during that time, I've experienced a lot of wonderful things. But most of all, I became very interested in how people think. And I think that's because in my own journey, when my son was diagnosed as dyslexic, we were given very much one way to move forward. It was a sort of one size fits all, and we should just work a bit harder at phonics. And of course, that for him wasn't the right way at all. And in our journey, it became very apparent that there's many, many different ways that people think. And that's really because thinking styles are a continuum and we all sit somewhere on that. And whilst we can put people largely into groups of thinking styles, everybody's very individual.
I think that how do we think question is the most important question we could possibly ask.
And the amazing thing is that I had never thought to think that thought. and that's pretty much what I found when I had the opportunity to do my master's dissertation, and I had the chance to study this, and I actually looked at Ron Davis's sort of idea that perception and dyslexia are very intricately linked, and realised that actually there had been no research on this. It's a great empty research area, which was quite fun.
Ron Davis, when he wrote The Gift of Dyslexia, I always interpret the fact that the gift of dyslexia is this perceptual ability that we're able to see things from all sorts of different angles.
It's funny because only now has light started to shed on the topic of dyslexia. And during your time working with dyslexia and people who have it, how much in your view has actually come out about it?
About how people think, do you mean?
How much has it helped you in your field of work, understanding how people think?
Oh, well, enormously, but particularly because of the way the Davis methods work. And the central preposition is that there is a link between perceptual talent and dyslexia. And that's what makes the dyslexic population different from the rest. And therefore, the methods, the Davis methods, you know, play to that and investigate their thinking style and use that as the strength, which is built upon in order to overcome whatever difficulties they might be encountering.
When we close our eyes and we imagine something, the place that's doing the looking, Ron Davis calls the mind's eye, right? And sadly, nobody has ever managed to photograph where my mind's eye is, right? I've got a good idea of where it is right now, but there's no way yet that we're able to photograph it. So it's a really difficult concept for many people to understand, right?
Well, the interesting thing was, though, when I started to study this and I looked at Ron Davis's idea that perceptual talent has got various characteristics, and he had four characteristics. One is that people who are dyslexic can experience mental images as real-world phenomena. He stated that they can consciously view these images three-dimensionally, and they can intentionally access the brain's perception distortion function, so they can do this at will, and that they have a preference to think non-verbally, which we often call visually, but it could be kinesthetically or not using words. Mm-hmm. And so when I set out to actually investigate this further, I wanted to see if it really was true that dyslexic individuals had this to a greater degree, as Ron stated, than non-dyslexic people. Mm-hmm. And that was actually really interesting because as I started the research, I found that everybody prefers visual thought or kinesthetic thought. Well, not everybody, but to a great degree. And I started my research by looking to see what else had been researched and discovered very little, except for Dr. Ross Cooper had done work on this. And he'd identified that 85% of the dyslexic population have a preference to think visually, but 65% of the non-dyslexic population have a preference to think visually. So,
did he ever explain why?
No, but what he did then discover was that it was more extreme. So the visuals that the dyslexic people are seeing are much more vivid than the non-dyslexic population.
Right.
And in both camps, there are people who prefer to have verbal thought. And we come across that in our work as Davis facilitators, that sometimes you meet somebody who is dyslexic, but they still come forward with verbal thought as their preference. And so that's what I started to explore. And I explored it by using the Davis tools. If anyone's familiar with how we do our perceptual ability test, where you rotate your mind's eye around a piece of cake. Mm-hmm. And I discovered that actually everybody could do that. But what was beginning to come in was the fact that people who were dyslexic could see in so much more detail, and they experienced it like a real life object, which is what Ron had said. So somebody who isn't dyslexic, they might imagine a piece of cake, but it's rather generic. It's just a piece of cake. Mm-hmm. And when they describe it, they would say, well, it's chocolate with icing. Whereas the dyslexic cohort would give a description about a piece of carrot cake that was fresh and crumbly and the icing's dripping and they can smell it.
Yeah.
And it's even a bit on it where it's been cut badly and it's starting to dry out. And, you know, we sit there and I'm thinking, I'm getting hungry here. And that comes through in a lot of research that dyslexic images, I don't really know what to call them, that doesn't sound the right way of saying it, but people who are dyslexic, when they're storing images, they store a lot of separate images. So they see everything as real life, whereas the non-dyslexic brain seems to merge them more into a single generic item.
Yeah.
So being non-dyslexic, when I think of a church, I just see a general generic church and it doesn't exist. Whereas Tristan, when you think of a church, you probably see a church at the end of your road or one that you're familiar with or many different churches.
I'm going inside of it right now, just visually. That, as you were describing and imagining opening the doors and walking in and having a look on the inside, all that fun stuff.
Which is amazing. So there were two things that I did when I was exploring this phenomenon. One was using Dr. Ross Cooper's shipwreck exercise, which I explain later. But what you've just said is reminding me. The second one was I just said to people, imagine that you're going to go for a weekend in the mountains and you've got to pack. How would you decide what to pack? And the people who are dyslexic did, Tristan, exactly what you've done. And they would say, well, while you were talking, I've been there. And yeah. I've had a look around and I'm familiar because I went to the Lake District last year and I know where we're going to stay and it's raining. I'm going to take my blue cagoule, and they would describe real items, and they had, in the space of my sentence, traveled there, assessed what they had to do, been through their real wardrobe and identified all those objects. That blew me away because I'm a verbal person. So I've got a list.
Yeah.
And it sort of goes, well, I'd need a hat and a scarf. And, you know, I sort of scan down my body or scan through my cupboard, perhaps. But I'm not really looking at real items. I'm writing a list that I could give to all members of my family and say, take one of these. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a huge difference because nothing on my list is real. It's just a jumper. And so when I come to pack, I still have to make the decision what jumper I'm going to take. Whereas this other area of the population, they've done it already.
They know.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's in the wash by then.
Yes. Yeah. So there's a tremendous difference.
Yeah. And it's interesting. And I know this is a slightly different topic, but, I've lost her name now.
Temple Grandin?
Thank you. Temple Grandin. She says that when somebody else reads the word shoe, they get a generic shoe, like you're just saying. When someone says shoe to her, she pictures every single shoe she's ever seen in her entire life, right?
Wow.
It's amazing, isn't it? So can you imagine the sort of overload that comes in here? Yeah, this is so cool, Sarah. Thank you.
Keep going. And I don't know, but I assume that this is also on a continuum. So you have somebody, you know, like she's describing, where it's right down the far end, and somebody else at the other extreme, which is very generic, and, you know, and the rest of us are all somewhere in between. And that's what makes it so interesting when you start looking to see how you can support somebody who's dyslexic or difficulties they've got. Because if you can start by seeing how strong their visual thought is or how strong their verbal thought is, then you can begin to look at possible strategies for how they could move forward.
And there is this continuum, because I do know one friend who has never, ever seen anything in her head at all.
Yeah.
She has never, ever had an image at all. And then you have Ron down the other end who has never had a sound in his head. So it's a big continuum. It's very interesting.
I think it's fairly rare, it's fairly uncommon to have no sound at all in your head, but it does happen.
Yeah.
And similarly, no images, but that's always an interesting one too, because people who haven't been aware of their images, when they go to the cinema and they see a movie, they will still be surprised to see that the movie isn't what they were expecting. So somehow you have got images in there.
Oh, that's interesting.
Do you not think? And of course, we recognize our friends and things. So there's a lot of pattern matching going on. So even though you're not conscious of the images, they're there somewhere. And certainly, personally, as a DAVIS facilitator, I kept meeting people who described how they could think. And it was so amazing that I put quite a lot of time into trying to bring back images. And I've managed to make my images better. But they're still grayscale.
This is interesting too, because when I first started my training, my images were always 2D. They were always like flat photographs.
Yes, right? So am I.
Well, when I was doing my training, I presume because I was in a room full of people who could do this, I remember Ron saying once, picture the house where you used to live, right? And up came the flat photograph of the house where I used to live. And then all of a sudden, whoa, it turned into 3D. And I found myself walking around the house and thinking, gosh, there were French windows there. And, oh, that's where the coal shed used to be. And I just couldn't believe. And I thought, this is what they're talking about. Wait, yeah. I can do this. But it's interesting that I presume I turned off that function at school because it wasn't doing me any good. I don't know, right? Honestly, I have no conscious recollection of that. But I think subconsciously I might have turned it off because it came back.
I mean, until I met you, Sue, I always saw in 3D models, but I had very little control over it. And even now, I still struggle because it's so quick seeing something. If someone says, oh, a car with the bonnet open, I immediately see a car with the bonnet open, a 3D model of it, but it's spun around in all which ways, and all of a sudden, it's been thrown somewhere else. So I oftentimes have to get myself aligned and focused to make sure I'm paying attention to the car. So if someone's trying to tell me there's this part over here, or whatever image it would be, I actually have to physically match the bonnet open. I'm looking from up top, and then I can see what's going on, and I take all the parts. And I may not know the name, but I know what each part does and how to look at it.
Yeah. I remember once listening to somebody who was talking about when they have a difficult problem to solve. And he said, imagine that you've got a row of houses, like we have in England, where all the houses are identical, a little terrace. And in each of those houses, which are the same layout, there's a different family living. Mm-hmm. And they're all doing different things. But then you take all those houses and you put them all one on top of the other. So you've got multiple houses in a single space. And that's your problem, that it's full of all the little problems, which are all tucked into the big problem. And he's got to find a way to start unraveling that. Now, I cannot conceive of how anybody can think like that. But Tristan, you're sort of nodding your head here as if you're thinking, well, that makes sense to you. Because I'm a word thinker, I unpack my problems in straight lines.
Yeah.
And I work out a sequential way of doing it. And I, you know, chug my way through it. And I'm really not going to come up with any great surprises at the end of it. So what are you doing when you're problem solving? What's happening in your head?
It's very all over the place a lot of the time. It's depending on what I'm doing. Like, again, with the car, if you're trying to take out a certain piece, you have to make sure you do it in a set order. And if I don't focus, it oftentimes goes, what about over here? I have to follow a linear way of doing something. So oftentimes, if someone asks me to answer a question, rather than going A plus B equals C kind of thing, I automatically look at it in all these different ways of answering the question or solving the problem. And sometimes I do it on purpose, and other times my brain just goes for it. And it's like opening a box with all these different little things and trying to take out everything at once and put it back in, but it's never exactly the right order, if that makes sense.
So are your thoughts three-dimensional, or are there more dimensions in there than that?
Oh.
That's a good question.
Because this analogy of the house, the houses, there's more dimensions than three dimensions because there's a sort of time element in there as well.
I was just going to say that because I've always had this difficult thing to get my head around when people say time is not linear and sequential. It's all happening at the same time. And I've never been able to get my head around that. But actually, that image of the houses sort of makes it a little easier to try and understand, at least. Sarah, keep going. This is fun. Oh, dear.
I've lost my train of thought because I'm sitting here now trying to make houses blur into themselves in my brain. And my brain just doesn't do that.
And I think this is the fun part of it, because people might be listening to this thinking, where are they going? Because we're all quite capable of butterfly thinking, right? And we've lost the linear track.
Totally. But then again, we've got this idea that somebody who's dyslexic is able to intentionally access the brain's distortion function. And you can see in this conversation already that Tristan is much better able to do that. He can access it at will. Maybe he can't manage it very well, but he can get in there and make all these things happen. And you have this amazingly wonderful thing that somebody who's dyslexic can be non-dyslexic because they can turn it off.
Yes.
You know, if you put all the Davis tools into place, you can think like a non-dyslexic individual.
Yeah.
And then you can go back to having this incredible thought. And I can't do that. So because I'm not dyslexic, I don't have the power to have the alternative way of thinking. So I'm missing that great chunk, which you guys have got, and I'm entirely envious of.
I think going back to where we were, I think we were going through those four characteristics that Ron was talking about.
Yes, which was that you can experience mental images as a real world phenomenon, look at them 3D, access the distortion, and this preference to think non-verbally.
Yes.
And maybe now I could explain to you the shipwreck exercise, because this is where you actually work out for yourself how you think.
Brilliant.
Okay. Now, the downside of doing this in a podcast is there's going to be a moment of quiet because I'm going to ask you both a question. So for the people listening to this, please bear with the moment of quiet because that has to be there. Okay. So I set you a problem. And the problem is that you're on a ship. It's a big ship and it's sinking. And for some strange reason, you're the only person on it. There's no cause for concern because there's a small boat and there's an island. And the boat's sinking, and you've got time to take three things. Get in the boat and go to the desert island, okay? So don't tell me till you've got all three. Take a moment and decide what three you would like. And this is where we now have the period of quiet, because I would like Sue and Tristan to take as long as they need to think what those things are. Okay, Sue looks like she's ready. Tristan's still thinking. Sue, what have you thought of?
I have a huge advantage because we've been binge watching the Pirates of the Caribbean.
Are you serious? I just watched Pirates of the Caribbean last night.
We managed 1, 2, 3, and 4. And you're always getting shipwrecked on this island. So I would take Jack Sparrow's compass. It always tells you where you want to go. I would take matches and a knife.
Okay. And Tristan, what did you choose?
I chose rope, water, and a knife as well.
Now, that's really interesting. Okay, so what's not important really is what you chose to take. But when you were doing that, were you seeing the ship in your head? Did you go onto the ship? Did you go on the island? What were you actually doing to solve that problem? Sue, what was happening in your head when you were doing that?
Oh, yeah. I've always fancied a life as a sea captain. I think it would be so much fun. So I love being on tall ships, and I was totally on the tall ship. I was collecting Jack Sparrow's compass. He was there because, obviously, who wouldn't want Johnny Depp to be there?
And did you go into the ship, or were you just looking at it like a bird's eye view?
No, I was on it.
Right. And was it all in colour or black and white?
Colour. I mean, I was holding the compass and I knew where the matches were in the knife.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and Tristan, what about you?
Because I watched Pirates of the Caribbean, I was also on the Black Pearl, but I imagined running through it, seeing what I could find quickly before the ship actually sank and what would actually be good to have. The rope I could use to tie along one tree to the next and then branch some big leaves over it to make a tent, the water, the drink, and the knife to cut down trees and stuff.
It's lovely survival stuff. Okay.
Yeah.
So what you've both done is you've shown that you've both got a preference for visual thought, but this does lend itself to visual thought. So you've both had very strong visual thought here, because it could have been that you were sort of bird's eye or I can't go in the boat. I can see the boat, but I can't go in it. Now you get to the island, and when you get there, it occurs to you that really you ought to have some food. So in the second part, what I want you to do is go back to the boat to get some food. But this time I'd like you to turn off your pictures and just hear it like words in your head. So it's a little bit as if you are talking to yourself in your head, like you're phoning yourself, say. So I want you to have the alternative mode of thought that you had in the beginning, and you both had the visual. So take a moment, go back to the ship, but without any pictures, and get some food. We have another moment of quiet. They're both looking very concentrated, eyes going all over the place.
Yeah. I can only think of one or two things that I'd need to eat.
But can you do it just with words in your head?
Kind of. I can see the words lining up, but it immediately shoots back and it wants to not do that. It wants to think of an image.
Hang on, you're seeing the words like written words.
Yeah.
Then they're not words, they're pictures.
Good point. Yeah, you're right.
So it's sound. Sue, can you get the sound in your head?
I'm surprised that you can see the words. That makes me smile, right?
Yeah. Because
I'm talking to myself in my head. I'm saying, now, come on, where are you going to find the food? You've got to go down to the hold. But as soon as I say the word hold, I've got the image. I stop talking to myself. And I have to really focus to get back to the sound.
This is where you can start to see the degree of preference coming in. Yeah. Because although Sue can bring in the words, she can't quite get rid of the pictures. Some people can bring in the words and it's really easy. They're really lucky because you know that when they're learning to read, they're going to be able to flip in and out of reading and hearing the words. They can think in words, they can process in words. And Sue, because she's got both of these actually coming in fairly easily, it's not going to be too difficult. Whereas Tristan, you can see that words for you are not a natural way of thinking. So you've got a much bigger translation process, that when you read something, it's a bit like reading French and speaking English. You've got to translate it from words into pictures.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was doing.
And this is where huge differences came out. So the non-dyslexic individuals could just do it in words. And they might have the pictures there as well, but they could have the words first and the pictures in the background. But if people were dyslexic, then they would be very much driven by the pictures. So they might have the pictures, but with a voiceover, but the voiceover came afterwards. One woman had a wonderful one where she would see the example of going on holiday and needing to pack. She would see her wardrobe, and then she would say to herself, "What shall I take on holiday?" And then the picture would move on a bit, but then it would stop. And then she'd have to interrogate her pictures again. And then they'd move on a bit further. And so she was using a combination of the two. But the problem solving was pictures, but the problem statement was in words.
And I found that when I talk to myself, if I say, now, where are we going to find food? There's a picture of food and we need to go to the hold. And there's a picture of hold. But the other words, as we know, they're not so obvious with their picture meaning. So I tend to get lost in those pictures and that knocks out the sound.
Well, it was interesting as well, because when Tristan chose his first things, he said rope, water, knife, and they sounded very generic. But then when we were describing what you saw, and you'd actually been to the island and you were setting up this whole place, you know, you'd actually gone through and set up your camp. Mm-hmm. So although your words, I had first thought, oh, that's interesting. I hadn't expected that you were going to have the generic terms. You had seen what they were. You weren't just doing it like a generic survival thing.
And now you're mixing up Pirates of the Caribbean with Survivor programs.
So this brought me on much further from Ron Davis's ideas, because whilst I could say it was true that there was a perceptual talent, dyslexia and perceptual talent were linked, it was also true that people who were not dyslexic could have perceptual talent, but to a lesser degree, because the richness of the pictures and the detail of the pictures, the speed of the pictures and the ability to access them was far more extreme. And it all comes down really to unpicking what's normal for people, because we all think that our way of thinking is normal, nothing else to judge it on. And these sort of conversations are interesting because you see how different all three of us are.
Absolutely. And I think that's where we have to understand how much our perceptual ability gets in the way in the 2D world. Do you know what I mean? I mean, some people, they can live with it, so to speak, if they're sort of mid-continuum. But if they're really down the end of the continuum with so much detail, then it does get in the way of our existence in the 2D world of print, right?
It does. And that's why the Davis tools are so powerful to help manage thought, because this fantastic three-dimensional multicolored thought is amazing, but it's disruptive and it gets in the way if you're not managing it well.
And you don't want to be seeing a lowercase d from all different angles, right? It's going to be a p and a b in a line with a blob.
Yeah.
It depends on the amount of interference, I guess. But I think it's also interesting to know that if you're sort of mildly dyslexic, then you're mildly talented in this way. And if you're very dyslexic, you're very talented in this way. And I think that the talents that come with the gift are also along those lines. Do you find that?
That is true. But of course, as you said, when you were younger, you'd sort of somehow put it away.
Yes.
So it doesn't correlate quite as smoothly as you think it would. You can have people who are very dyslexic and they will say they don't get pictures, as you had said. hopefully they're there somewhere, and hopefully one day they'll find them back. But it's not as smooth and obvious as that. And everybody's got a little bit of everything.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're all our own mixture on the continuum. And Ron always says there's as many different types of dyslexia as there are dyslexics, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Oh, this is interesting. Yeah. Thank you so much for this. So, Sarah, what message would you like to leave everybody with?
Goodness. Well, yes, I think it's very important for people to play these sort of games with their own thought processes, to explore how they think and how their thoughts best suit them, and then to think how they can best use that to learn. And if they find that, you know, their thoughts are careering off in all directions, learn to manage them.
Yeah.
And there's no wrong or right way of thinking.
No.
It's important to know what it is.
I couldn't agree more. And I mean, my particular thing at the moment is to try and get Davis learning strategies into schools from day one, because the methods that you and I use for our correction programs, if we get them into schools preventatively, all the children are reached. Those two learning styles, they don't have to develop into difficulties. They don't have to develop into challenges.
No, that's right, because the Davis tools of release and focusing and managing your energy are, in a way, all that you need to manage your thoughts. And if you can slow them down and capture them and look at them and discard the ones you don't want, you'll fly.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the self-management thing is so important, because honestly and truthfully, we are the only people that can manage ourselves. And when you see teachers trying to manage a classroom where the kids are careering off into la la land, I mean, it's an impossible task. Nobody can manage my mind's eye. I'm the only person who can do that.
That's right. Yeah.
It also helps a lot of students who are fresh into school, and they would have options. If the image-based way of working works for them, then they get to choose to use that way of thinking. And if it doesn't work for them, they can go right back to the sound-based.
And the little ones aren't going to be able to tell you how they think. So the point is, it's important, I think, to just introduce both ways from day one.
Yeah, when they're very little, they do have a preference for visual thought, because that's what we're all born with.
Exactly.
You know, we have no words. So it's only once we learn to talk and have external communication with words, then we develop verbal thought. So a lot of these kids are learning to read before they've even developed internal verbal thought. So it would be much easier if these options were offered up front.
And I think if the Davis way of learning was adopted in schools, the schools and the students and even the teachers would be so much more accepting of the dyslexic way of thinking, right? Because then people could understand why this person is struggling, how this person is thinking, rather than just go, oh, he's dyslexic, he just needs to try harder. Because oftentimes that's what I heard, was just dyslexic people have to try harder.
Which brings us very neatly back to talking the dis out of dyslexia. Because dis, in actual fact, only means difficulty. Lexia is with words. And we might have difficulty with words, but we're not actually disabled. That's the point.
So that's a hugely important point. And I think there's also a big movement which is beginning to realise that the disability is being brought in because of the way society sets up their schooling system, because of the way that we judge people in the schools, because of the way we teach reading. And if all those things were changed, then we wouldn't be disabling our children. They would just be different. And that's the best thing to be. Everybody wants to be different.
That couldn't be a better way to finish. And Sarah, thank you so very, very much, because I've thoroughly enjoyed that. I really have. Thank you.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure to be here. Yeah.
And maybe we can have another chat one day.
That'd be lovely.
Was that not fun? So now, do you know you're predominantly a verbal or nonverbal thinker? Or are you a good mixture? Or are you still deciding? One of my friends said that if one third of the population thinks non-verbally, then one third of the teacher training should cover that, which I thought was quite a good point, right? Again, you can reach us at www.thewds.org. If you have any requests or questions, please just reach out to us. Next time, what are phonics, phonemics, and phonetics?